Today's podcast is a member of the Place to Be Nation family. Visit us at placetobenation.com, the only place to be in your pop culture world.
All right, let's get it going here on Diamond Conversations, being brought to you today here on the Place to Be Nation podcasting network. If you didn't know by now, my name is Ian, and every single week we sit down and have a diamond conversation with somebody involved in the world of Major League and professional baseball. And today we welcome in former Major League star, a guy who played for a couple of teams. I remember him coming up with the Mets, played with the Orioles, and he's now coaching at Kaiser University. I welcome in today Mr. Brooke Fordyce. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me. Hope all's well and everybody's safe, but I love talking baseball, so let's go.
Let's talk some baseball, because down there with Kaiser University, you guys look to be like dominating before the COVID epidemic or pandemic hit and kind of put the brakes on your season. But before we get into that, how's everything going with you and the team and everybody down there in your neck of the woods?
Well, doing well. I'll actually let you know that I did. I would test positive for COVID back.
Oh, did you?
Yeah, my parents.
Oh, wow.
Self. Knock on wood. We had no symptoms. But what was happening is they were going to fly home with my daughter back up to Massachusetts where she lives, and just to be safe, everybody tested. My daughter didn't test positive, but my parents and myself with no symptoms. But we're, I think, 40 days out. We're doing well, and we're back at action. So that being said, we had to go through that, obviously, personally.
Well, I'm glad to hear everybody's doing okay. I'm obviously, that was kind of caught me off guard, but very, I'm very happy for you to hear that you're doing well and the family's doing well.
Well, appreciate it. But it's a touching moment, and obviously we're all affected by it. And like you said, we were in the middle of a great season. I think we're on our way to one of our best seasons, with win record, and the COVID came, and obviously everybody did the right thing. This is much bigger than sports at this point in time.
Yeah, and you get to see what it was like, firsthand, because we watched how spring training was just shut down, and we've been talking about it here on the air for a couple of weeks. Like, we started to get breadcrumbs. Are they going to resume the season? Is it coming July 4th? Is it coming the end of July? And we see it's, on the horizon. But for you, you guys were in the heart of playing, and you got to see how it was. So what did they do to you first? Did they kind of give you a warning, or was it just shutting up shop, out of the blue?
We played a weekday game on Tuesday, and it seemed that Wednesday that there was a good chance they were going to cancel our weekend series, which was going into spring break anyhow. That Wednesday was solidified. They're saying, hey, listen, this is unknown. We're going to close it down. And that's really when it happened. It happened around March 18th, I think. And when that news came, it was just a big deep breath. Realized there was something bigger and more important than baseball. And I just really gathered myself and really how I was going to tell the team, because, you've got 30 guys that, are emotionally and invested in this, and that's all they want at that point in time.
So, yeah, how do you handle that with, obviously, at this age, they're very impressionable. They're listening to coach. They're listening to everything that you're kind of guiding them with. Is it one thing where you have to mentor certain guys and kind of tell them what's going on, or was this a team-based, conversation, maybe a Zoom call, that you had to share this news with everyone?
No, fortunately I got to meet with him in person, and I was more stern with it. I was like, listen, as much as personally we want this and individually we want this and as a team we want this, this is something that nobody's been through, not in my lifetime anyhow. So I said, this is much bigger than us. So how we handle this is more important than playing a few more games.
Right.
I approached it that way, and I was dead serious with it. And I think they got that, hey, listen, whatever this is, it's stronger. At that time, we were still unknowns, but we didn't know. And they took it, and obviously it was something big, bigger than we are. And so, I came across stern and said, hey, listen, this is bigger than sports right now. Let's make sure we're safe. Our families are safe, our grandparents. And that's how we went with that. And then a week or 2 weeks later, obviously everybody went home and did online class.
Wow. Yeah. I mean, that's just unbelievable. Now, do you give them advice on how to stay warm, how to stay in shape, in this? Is that something, again, they're seeking you out to ask these kinds of questions?
Yeah. So what we did was, obviously we're in the middle of our season, having a great season. So what I did, and I was lucky and I'm fortunate with my background, we had Zoom meetings every Wednesday. I had Eduardo Perez, Ken Griffith,
oh, very nice.
Ken Griffey jumped on. Pat Henkin and Johnny Damon talked to the boys, you know, to get that, you know, give them something to look forward to, obviously, when we're going through this. And those guys came on for about an hour once a week, and we just had great fun with it and talking shop.
Now, that's awesome. And it seemed like that was a good way to kind of keep everybody, you know, in a good state of mind, was to be able to really bring to the front a lot of baseball talk. And we've talked about it with writers on the show and other former players. Like, we've seen all the classic games to death. We've heard all the lists, the top 10 this, the top 10 that. But that's great that you're able to kind of tap into, you know, people that you know and get them in there to keep these guys motivated and talking. That's really cool.
Yeah, it was. It's you got to keep them connected with you. And again, I don't know what they're thinking. They haven't been through this, and we just want to make sure that there's a positive, you know, light to this as well.
Yeah, absolutely. So where are you guys in terms of, you know, the thought of either, obviously, I don't know if resuming the season's going to, obviously, probably not going to happen, but in terms of the next year and coming, like, what have you guys had plans? Have you had discussions yet?
So we had broke out our Zoom meetings a couple weeks ago, let them have their summer, right? Enjoy that as much as they can. And then we're planning on starting back up in September.
Great.
Yeah, we're fall ball that is. So, right. You know, they get together, we start practices, and, you know, we're looking to move forward, waiting on what we hear. Are we going to online classes? Are we doing a hybrid type thing? But, you know, I'm trying to keep the energy positive and you know, the goals out there so that, you know, we don't get any drifters or wanderers.
Right. And I love, you know, what you're talking about with classes. So obviously, you know, you're stressing the academic side of it in a lot of ways, because that's just as important as furthering your skills and making yourself a better ball player. How much of the academics plays into a player's performance throughout the year? Do you see how they kind of go up and down, you know, if they are struggling on the academic side?
I'll be honest with you. And it was in my, and same in my case, I believe when you're playing baseball and you have something to look forward, your time management, your focus, knowing that at the end of the day, there's a game. I think they actually could do better and did better in the spring because they have something to look forward to, right?
Right.
Their time management's already set for them. Well, sometimes with the young kids, if they don't have something to look forward to, their time management's off, and, you know, a lot of, obviously their grades are affected, but, you know, we stay on top of it. We recruit character first. If they've got good character, then, you know, we can build on that with resources and whatever they need to be better people and better baseball players.
Now, have you been paying attention to what's been going on with the major league season and the trials and tribulations of, you know, what either is lying in front of us or potentially a start and stop? Obviously now somebody that we know, you know, had, you know, the sickness, you know, it's one of those things where one guy gets it on a team during this thing, it could wipe out a whole staff. So have you been following this whole development?
I have been following it. I obviously don't have inside scoops. Obviously I, you know, everybody's pushing for something, some normalcy. I get it, but, you know, I don't know what it looks like, because there is a good chance, according to the numbers, that somebody's going to get it. Quarantines are 14 days, you know, so I don't know what it looks like. I would hate for something to get started and then stopped. I've always been told once you get it going, keep it going. But I would hate for see a short season or shortened season.
Yeah, I mean, there was, you know, worry about Jacob DeGrom and his arm the other day. Like, basically, if he missed opening day, that's going to be a couple starts. And in this 60-game season, you know, this is very NCAA Final Four tournament style. That could cost the team a whole chance at winning. And it's so delicate that if that happens, man, I shudder to think where we're at. You know, the only comparisons I think baseball can draw is the 1981 season, where it was a little off and a little weird. But, you know, again, it's just kind of shrugging our shoulders and seeing what's going to happen.
Well, 60 games. Listen, the average, what, DL times 14 to 21 days, right? That's almost half the season. So, you know, I don't know. It's a crazy time. I like that we're trying to push through this as long as we're doing it safely, because, you know, like I said, the rest of us, the country needs some normalcy soon.
Oh, absolutely. And I'll tell you what, you know, just going back and looking at, you know, your career and how you got drafted, 1989, third round by the Mets. I was looking at the draft picks in front of you. Alan Zinter, highly touted Mets prospect. Tom Engel, and then yourself, who was very highly touted Mets prospect for a long time. That when we finally saw you, you know, it was like we were waiting all these years to see you get to there. Take us back to being drafted by the Mets in 89. What the process was like? Were you scouted ahead of time? And kind of what was going through your mind when you were drafted by the team?
So I grew up in a small town in East Lyme, Connecticut. Obviously, you know, not major in the baseball market compared to Florida, Texas, and California. But I was an All-American my senior year, going into my senior year. And I got a lot of, pro scouts coming out. I originally signed to go to Clemson for 4 years with Coach Bill Wilhelm was at that time. So I didn't think about, I mean, I thought about going pro, but I really just thought about competing every day. Small town kid, not seeing what's out there. I just wanted to compete and be the best in my local area, then in my state, and then whatever happened. It came to realization that I probably would get drafted probably 2 months out, maybe a month out. I had an invite to Yankee Stadium and then Shea Stadium with the top players, the local, or I should say the regional area guys, and showed well, I guess. But by no means did I know that I was going to be a third round pick. I wanted to be a top five, only egotistically, but not only that, because I knew it would make it my job going to college easier. You know, if I put limits on it and you're not that good, Brooke, then go get your education, have fun playing college baseball. But I had no idea I'd be a third round pick. That day was amazing. One of my most memorable days.
So who gives you the call at that point? Is it Joe McElvain? Was he still with the organization? Who's doing the draft phone call?
So back in then, they didn't have it on TV.
None of that.
The phone call, I would say around 4 o'clock from Paul Beretta, who's the scout.
Okay.
Yep. He called me and congratulated me. And then he said, okay, I'll be there tomorrow to sign you. And I'm like, whoa, whoa, whoa. You know, tomorrow's too early. I think that was a Wednesday or Tuesday or Wednesday, whatever it was. I think we met up on a Thursday or Friday, 2 days later, to at least, you know, wrap my head around what just happened. So he was really ready to sign me right then. And I'm like, well, I got some thinking to do. But great moment. A lot of emotions went through. A lot of me just saying all that hard work paid off, and it was just a pat on my back for about a half a day, and then get back to reality.
And in the time where Mets, I was looking at the picks. I was actually surprised they had three consecutive rounds of picks because they were so good and they were signing top guys. I was surprised they actually still had three consecutive rounds of picks. But as a catcher, Todd Hundley's also on the same track as you. So it's kind of interesting to see how, the path was going to be to the major league. So kind of talk about the minor league journey and what it was like going through the Mets system.
So, you get signed. So at 1 minute you're on the top of the hill, right? You're doing everything. You're the man. And then you get sent to Rookie Bowl. And for me, I've always been business about baseball. It's just, what can I do? How do I take care of myself? What do I eat? How do I get sleep? And that was it. I mean, the minor leagues, if you like the minor leagues, you're probably not going to make the big leagues. I hated every minute in the minor leagues. I hated the bus drives. When I say I hated it, it was just a reminder. You're not supposed to stay here.
Right.
So, it was my motivation, but, I got down to Kingsport. I didn't know what to expect first year with a wood bat. I hit 327 with, I think, 9 home runs. And, I had a great first year. So I was like, okay, I can do this. I belong. I can play with the best people in the country. And then next year I went to Columbia, South Carolina, and had another career year, hit 315 with 10 home runs. So I'm moving up. I'm getting noticed. Obviously, as a catcher, I still had a lot of work to do. And then the St. Lucie Mets stop. I did okay. It was different for me because, being a Northeastern boy, playing in a 99-degree weather in the summer, it takes a toll. I think I lost 15 pounds that year.
Wow.
I finished skinny. Again, got out of A-ball, got to Double A, which was Binghamton, New York, and that was 92 is our first year in Binghamton. Had a really good year there. MVP of the World Series, which we won. And then got to Norfolk, which I loved there. But got to Great Norfolk, place. Brand new stadium in 93. And
That's right.
started off the first, 15, 20 games really good. And then it hit me. I had to make an adjustment. And I had my worst year in the minor leagues there. And AAA was, I was 21, just turned 22. And I just realized the older guys that are around, the pitchers, they pitch different. And I had to make some adjustments. So that was a real big learning year for me. And that was 92 and went back 93. Unfortunately, I had an injury, a staph infection in my left knee that I lost 2/3 of the season. So,
wow.
So that was my stint with the Mets. Obviously, with the strike year, I did get to the big leagues with them for about 30 days, and then they put me on waivers. And then I ended up with Cleveland in 1995 for Triple A for the summer, and then signed as a free agent the next year with the Cincinnati Reds. And that's really when I got to the big leagues.
So when you got in the minor leagues, who's the first coach or who's the first guy to kind of start to needle you a little bit to kind of give you the ropes of, you're not in college anymore. You're here. You're ready to play. Who's the first guy that kind of takes you under their wing and gives you the business?
Bill Stein was my first manager. He was awesome. And I meant that he was awesome for me is because I'm not a guy you have to tell twice. He told me what this was about, that their resources are there. I'm supposed to use them. Nobody babysits. Nobody holds your hand. And I went off and had a great year. And he was just there to remind me more of the mental side of how to deal with things, not the physical. And I thought he was a great first-time manager. Then I got to Johnny Tamargo. And I think that's where, he gave me that toughness, like, hey, listen. You had one good year, but you got to do this for a lifetime. And he really got to me. He's a former catcher as well, Johnny Tamargo. Just mentally, I think I got tougher from that. But throughout the Mets, probably my best manager gave me the most. And probably I was more mature at that time was Steve Swisher.
Okay.
I had him in AA when we won it. And he talked really about, hey, a lot of good things are happening, but, you've got to still push. This is a dog-eat-dog world, especially in baseball. One day you're good, and the next day you're terrible. So I would say Steve Swisher pushed me on to probably get to where I needed to be to have my professional career.
I think Doug's going to tag in here. He finally was able to join us. Come on, Doug, jump up.
All right, Brooke. So I had a quick question about, some of those last years with the Mets organization. Yep. What was it like finally getting the call after being in the organization for 6 years? You only, like you said, you only spent about 30 days with the big league club, but, did you make the team out of spring training in 95?
That was the strike year. So here's how. So, they had an expanded roster. I hadn't been cut yet. So I'm like, I talked to Steve Swisher, who at that time was the big league coach. And I'm like, listen, I haven't been cut yet. I haven't been told I'm going. What do you do? He goes, you bring your luggage no matter what. Tomorrow you're going to find out no matter what, whatever they tell you. I think he already knew the answer. But so I'm sitting there going, I have no idea. Am I going north, south, west, east, where, whatever. So I bring my luggage. And then the day goes on. We play our last game. I get a pinch hit, I believe. I want to say in spring training and won the game. It was great. Okay. And I'm like, okay, here it comes. The Dallas is, they're gonna pull me in and send me somewhere. Next thing you know, bus calls there. I jump on the quick as I can and hid behind the seats. And that's how I was told. Nobody ever told me I wasn't going. So I did exactly what everybody else did. And next thing you know, that's how I knew I was in the big leagues is when I landed in New York.
And then your first hit comes across, off Jeff Fusaro. Tell me about that, getting that out of the way.
I was just shell-shocked and, wide-eyed little kid back then. And I'm sitting there going, okay, a pinch hit. So I come up and I'm like, oh, okay. And thank heavens it was a great mix for me as a left-hand pitcher. He didn't throw hard. So I didn't have to, emotionally get stressed out. And I got a pitch, a fastball up, and I hit it to the right center gap for a double. It was great, but I didn't really, cheer and wasn't in the moment because I think at that time it was a close ball game. And so I was just like, okay, I got a hit. And then what do I got to do? Oh, my God, I got to think about scoring here. So, after that night, I kind of sat back, got the ball, signed it, and was like, okay, hopefully that's one, but I'm not dwelling on it. I want more. I'm hungry.
Oh, it's crazy. I love those Met teams from that era. And, you know, growing up as a Met fan, I got it around my neck. I can tell you, looking in the yearbook every year and seeing your name and remembering going to Norfolk that first year that that stadium opened. That was a big deal. So that was a beautiful facility to go watch a game in.
Yeah, it was phenomenal. It really was a great place.
No, it absolutely was. But, you know, and oddly enough, Baltimore would become the later home of the Orioles, or Norfolk, excuse me. But you saw your best success with the Orioles. So kind of talk about the years with Baltimore and the organization and kind of finding, you know, your rhythm and really, you know, having a nice couple of years in Baltimore.
Well, it really started off for me. I really thought with Cincinnati. I want to go back to that because.
Sure, absolutely.
I had a short stint there where I started playing, you know, four or five games consecutively. And I swung the bat well and the team won. But for whatever reason, I didn't get my playing time. It is what it is. That's the way the game is. And so, you know, I went to backup role there and I thought, man, maybe I missed my opportunity. They eventually traded me to the White Sox. And that's where I really knew I could play. I played part-time with Mark Johnson and I hit 298 with 9 home runs. I knew that I could play then. And in 2000, I come back. I broke a foot. So I missed a third of the season, a little bit of that. Came out hitting really well. And next thing you know, when it came to the trade deadline, I got traded to Orioles for Harold Baines. and Charles Johnson. They went to White Sox for the playoff run. I went to Baltimore. And that's when the Baltimore Orioles, when they started dumping out, you know, the Will Clarks and all those like guys that they had.
And we actually just talked to Mike Trombley about that team and the veteran presence that they had of the Will Clarks, the Harold Baines, Ripken, and everybody else, Charles Johnson. And you come in literally as that's now starting to get picked apart piece by piece. So you're coming into a new breed and a new, you know, basically a new face of the team. So kind of what was that adjustment like for you?
Well, you know, for me, I don't know why I got traded, but I'm sure it was the right thing for the White Sox. But I looked at it and was like, okay, I'm still not established. I'm still hunting for a place. I'm hunting for at bats. I want to play. I want to prove that I can play. So, you know, the trade came. I was like, okay, guess what? Nobody promised you anything. Got on a red eye from California to, it was a Sunday game. I landed in around 6:30, 7:30 a.m. It was a Sunday day game. I got there and I stayed outside the stadium because it wasn't even open till about 7:30, 8 o'clock when the equipment manager showed up and he goes, who are you? I'm like, well, I'm the catcher you guys traded for. He goes, oh, we were told you weren't going to come for 2 or 3 days. I was like, no, I'm here. So I suited up and played that day against the Cleveland Indians. I remember that. But I got to play. You know, they gave me the opportunity to play and I went out and I just excelled. I embraced the challenge and the opportunity and just loved every minute of it.
So what's your first impression of Baltimore as a baseball city?
It's deserving of a winning team. It's deserving. It has a great market, has great fan base, and it really wants to win. You know, back in the old days, they've had some great traditions, and they're an organization and a franchise that deserves to win again and be on top. Tough conference, tough East, though. It's a tough East. AL East is tough, but they deserve to win.
I find it funny. You just missed Davey Johnson by a few years in Baltimore, and you just missed him by a few years with the Mets. So it's kind of, it's funny. It's just one of those things. And with the Reds, he wasn't with the Reds at that point when you were going through. So yeah, you missed him there too. So kind of funny. You were not destined to play for the guy that the team that you originally drafted you had in the seat. But Hargrove is a manager. How was he? Because again, it was a transitional team with a veteran presence that was getting picked apart. So how was he to play for?
So I don't know, Mike, how he was with Cleveland with those great teams, right? That was supposed to win, the pressure on him. And then, you know, he came to Baltimore and that team was just star studded. It was unbelievable. You know, you had Alomar, you know, you had Robbie Alomar. So, when it happened to him, I'm quite sure inside he's sitting there going, my days are numbered. What am I getting? I got four dice at catcher. No offense, Trombley. I got Trombley pitching, right? And it went really young on us, right? Really quick. And he was awesome. He was awesome. And he's like, okay, if this is the hand I'm dealt, I'm going to make these guys understand this is a job. This is what they need to do if they want to have a career up here. And I thought he was amazing with the young guys. I really do. And again, you know, it was a tough situation for him, but a lot of guys had got their opportunity they might not have in any other organization.
It always seemed on paper those Orioles teams were primed and ready to go, and it just seemed like something always happened, whether it was injuries or a losing streak or something. But it was just, it's weird because they're either really, really good or they kind of just, they're kind of like right here. So you got to see that the teams all had potential and to be great winners, but it was just something that always kind of was there. And now how about when Ripken retires? So does the team lose any bit of that, you know, that firm constant that now in 2001, he retires and, you know, you're there still in the post Ripken year.
In all fairness to Cal, I mean, obviously he's a great ambassador of baseball, period, and a great player, period. But I think what happened when he was there and it started changing and he was the only constant, I think it became Cal, you know, about Cal, because, you know, he's finishing out, obviously his career, which is amazing. And, right. You know, the team wasn't as good and wasn't that competitive, unfortunately, for him. So it almost took on, okay, well, it's Cal's final tour, and then the Baltimore Orioles get to play. Yeah, and in all fairness, he deserved that. But I don't think that there was, you know, we were trying to fight for each job. You know, everybody was trying to keep a job. So it was great kids, great guys. But I just don't know if the concept of winning and let's try to beat the Yankees, Red Sox were really, really there.
Yeah, I mean, still great. I mean, no, Jeff Conine, great veteran presence. It was still a great team. But again, like on paper, they looked like at the beginning of the year, if you're in Baltimore at the beginning of the baseball year, you think the Orioles are going to win 200 games because they're so motivated. And it was always tough to watch to see the team kind of fall apart. But I'm going to welcome Doug back in because we're going to have you put on the gear. You're going to put on the catcher's gear. You're going to put on the batting helmet. We're going to hit you with some stats here before we get into the wrap up.
Oh, jeez.
So, Brooke, I like asking people, you know, sort of what they remember about most hits, stuff like that. But as you're talking about the Yankees and those tough teams, I broke it down to just your time with the Orioles. You hit 368 off Andy Pettit with 7 hits. You hit 500 off Clemens, 7 for 14. And you went 4 for 10 with a 444 average off Mariano Rivera. So in that time period when the Yankees are just destroying everyone in baseball, especially that division, was there anything different about your game going up against them? What was about those pitchers?
My career, if you look at the Red Sox and the Yankees, I already did well, always did well. We didn't have much success winning games. So I think what happened was they looked at me in the batter's box and I said, let this little guy hit. He ain't going to hurt us. So, you know, they pitched Conine hard and they pitched the rest of the lineup hard, but they gave in to me and let me get my hits. No, I don't know how to tell you other than I always liked and geared up for the bigger teams.
Interesting. So do a little Brooke Fordyce trivia here. If I can throw a couple questions at you. There is one person that you had more than 9 hits against in your career, the person that you had the most hits against in your career. Do you know who it is?
Most hits in my career. Wakeman? No, Wakefield?
It is not Wakefield. He's up there.
Yeah.
It's a teammate of his.
Team. Oh, Lowe.
Derek Lowe.
Yep, Lowe. I knew once you said that, because I remember he's like, how do you keep hitting me? I was like, I don't know. I like we would lose a game like 2-0 and I would have 2 or 3 hits. And I said, don't ask me. I don't know.
Now, on the other end, so you've got 1 home run against many major league pitchers. You've got 2 against Tim Wakefield and Mike Jackson. Yep. You hit 4 home runs against 1 pitcher and they were all your hits against him. Do you know who it was?
Jeez. No.
4 for 10, 4 home runs.
Wow.
I'm trying to think. I have no, you blanked me.
Mark Redman.
You know what? I was going to just say that, Mark. I was, because I remembered somebody saying, you know, you used to kill. That's right. That's right. I'm like, see, but you forget. Because, if you're dwelling in that moment, you know, he's like, okay, that's one more. Try to get one more. Stick around one more day. So, wow, that's good. No, I got to remember that stat.
And then on the flip side, you struck out against Hideo Nomo 6 times in your 12 at-bats against him. Someone else up there, Mike Mussina, gave you trouble, even though you caught him previously. Can you talk about what it's like facing someone that you have caught before?
So, two different, obviously, perceptions, right? Hitting and then catching. The thing about when I was catching Mike Mussina is wherever I set the glove up, he'd hit it with any pitch, fastball, curveball, slide. I mean, he was just amazing. He really was. Now, hitting, it just seemed like it always had movement. I couldn't see it enough. I mean, his deception, his curveball. But I anticipated his curveball when I was catching. Oh, this is easy. Then you turn around and you look at a different perception and you're like, oh, man. And He literally could do anything he wanted with baseball. It was fun to catch, not fun to hit.
That's great. No, that was, you know, we would get Mark Redmond on. I bet you he'd say that the toughest guy he couldn't get out was Brooke Fordyce. So there's a flip side of that. Now, before we wrap up, and we're going to talk about the Seahawks again, we got to ask about the memorabilia behind you. It's the elephant in the room. I've been staring at it the whole time. What do you got behind you? What's the marquee piece?
Oh, my gosh. I don't know if there is a marquee piece. They're all – there's Chipper Jones' bat, Manny Ramirez, Nomar Garciaparra. I mean, everybody I played with. I've got the Yankees, Giambi, Jeter, Rodriguez, you name it. And then the baseballs, you know, Maddox, Clemens, Randy Johnson, Glavin. I mean, you keep going on. Now, I have Mark McGwire baseball that when he hit 60, I was catching.
Oh.
Yeah, so when that they just had that 30-30, I was catching when he hit number 60. And I have posters on the other side of the office with him signing it saying, what a great day. So it's just anybody that I admired throughout the year, I've got them. Jim Thome, you know, Paul Konerko, obviously, Ordonez. It just goes on and on. I try to get everybody's autographs back.
That's awesome. No, I'm just staring at it. It's one of my things. So I'm just staring at the stuff behind you. And it's very well displayed. That's another plus. So very cool to see you have all that.
Thank you.
So, all right. Well, let's get into the wrap up here. You know, we've been talking to Brooke Fordyce and we're talking about the Kaiser University Seahawks, where, like we said, they were dominating. They were doing great. 19-6 before the COVID hit and, you know, and hopefully restarting in the fall. So before we wrap it up, you know, talk about frozen ropes, talk about whatever you got. And so and the floor is yours.
Well, you know, with the Kaiser thing, and that's what this is really about. Kaiser University is coaching college baseball players. And, you know, my experience, here's what's funny. A lot of the kids don't want to hear about when I played or how I played. They have their different techniques or whatever. But I tell them the game's still the same mentally, you know, and how you approach your business. And I'm relating to kids now. I mean, the game has changed since I played. I think these are all my opinions. I like the way the game was played when I played because I succeeded, I think, at it. Now there seems to me, again, these are all my thoughts, less team, more about me, a little bit more about show and entertainment. And I still love the game and I accept it because that's bringing fans in, which keeps our game, you know, obviously going. But the mental toughness, I really, really hone in on how hard it is, period, in life to be successful, the discipline, the commitment, not just to the baseball field, but to the everyday activities and things you need to do in life. And, you know, I think we touch base there. I relate with the players, but I remind them that, you know, we're not that good. We're not that bad. If we keep playing, then we can make a difference. And the only thing we'll let us know is over time.
That's fantastic. And again, you know, just reading about the program and how much success you've had there. It's so cool. Great baseball story. Wonderful to hear it. We really hope you get back on the field and you guys are rocking and rolling, but also that you're feeling better and you're doing well. And that to me is the most important thing. And again, thank you for sharing that earlier in the interview.
Well, yeah, thank you. Thank you for having me on. I always like talking the game. It's hopefully it stirs up interest or answers questions and it keeps baseball alive in people's hearts.
Now, behind you, do you have the first ball from your first hit?
I do. It's probably dead center in the bottom one. It's dead center. Oh, yep, it's dead center there, and that's the only one of me. Everybody else, it's the other stuff is more worth more stuff.
Very nice. See, I knew it would be on there. That's why I had to throw it out. So, all right. Well, we're going to head into this wrap. You've been listening to Diamond Conversations. If you want to follow me on Twitter, it's at Chad EMB. If you want to follow the producer extraordinaire, Doug, it's at Doug Barclay 17. And this has been the place to be nation's finest, Diamond Conversations with Brooke Fordyce. And if that's not enough of us now, then I don't know what to tell you. We'll catch you the next time. Take care.
Promotional consideration paid for by the following. Place to Be Nation's JT Rosero and Chad Campbell here. We want to let you know that we have over 24 podcasts available on iTunes, Stitcher, Google Play, and PlaceToBeNation.com. We now offer them to you on two great feeds. On the Place to Be Nation wrestling feed, we dive into topics running the gamut from today's WWE to the glory days of yesteryear and the ins and outs of the territory days. In addition to our full-length shows, we also deliver to you special pod blasts on topics old and new.
The Place to Be Nation pop feed is a veritable treasure trove of great content. Offer tremendous shows covering the land of movies, television, life, comics, and sports, brought to you by the most knowledgeable and insightful folks in the podcast world.
You can find all these great shows, plus archives of our past podcasts from over the past 8 years as well by subscribing to both feeds on iTunes. And while you're there, be sure to rate and leave feedback as well. All of these shows, plus others, available on PlaceToBeNation.com, where we cover pro wrestling, sports, movies, comics, plus in-depth search projects, and much more. Be sure to support our site by using www.PlaceToBeNation.com/Amazon when doing your online shopping. We want to thank our friends at Boneheads, Wing Bar, ProWrestlingOnly.com, and TheHistoryOfWrestling.com as well. Be sure to follow us on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, and Tumblr. PlaceToBeNation.com, the only place to be in your pop culture.